This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Halo, Retribution by Troy Denning. Read by Scott Brick.
Historian's Note. The events of this novel take place in December 2553, approximately 5 months after the discovery of an Archeon-class Ancilla in Halo Last Light, and 2 months after Veda Lopez's ferret team is imperiled in the Halo Fractures story, A Necessary Truth. Chapter 1. 1432 hours, December 12th, 2553, military calendar. Trattoria Georgi, New Tyne, Planet Venezia, Cab System. The gunrunner in the corner booth was not the usual space trash. Wearing a high-necked tunic with an embroidered collar, he sat with three rough-looking lackeys, sipping a golden cordial while his companions gulped Hiskel and Watha. His head was fashionably shaved, his dark beard closely trimmed, his eyes amber and thoughtful. And his smile? It was quick and bright, an invitation to fun and trouble that almost made Oni operative Veda Lopez regret what she was about to do to him. Almost. Leaving her backup team at the table, she rose and started across a small dining room packed with customers, mostly human and Kigyar. As she drew near the gunrunner's booth, a huge Jirohanai bodyguard stepped away from the wall to block her way. Tall enough that his head scraped the ceiling, he had a raw-boned face with pebbly gray skin, a sloped brow, and 20-centimeter fangs rising from a massive jaw. Veda continued toward him, unfazed. Her backup team might look like over-pierced street punks, but they were Spartan III super soldiers, and all three were palming M6P pocket pistols, loaded with 4 rounds of high-explosive ammunition. If the Jirohanai got rough, he'd be dead before he landed a single blow. 2 meters from the brute, Veda stopped. "Easy, big guy," she said. To prove she was unarmed, she pulled up her shirt tail and turned around slowly. "I'm here to talk business." The Jirohanai snarled and pointed a huge finger back toward her table. She had been careful to position herself outside her team's line of fire, so his arm extended at an angle that opened his ribcage to attack. Reassured by his ineptitude, Veda merely circled around his other side and, with the gunrunner calmly watching, continued toward the booth. "Just hear me out," she said. The Jirohanai was already spinning around to grab at her, but Veda slipped aside and hitched a thumb back over her shoulder. "Trust me, it'll be better for everyone." The gunrunner glanced toward Veda's table, where she knew her team would be on the verge of opening fire. His smile grew wry, and he quickly signaled his bodyguard to stand down. "Rude and dangerous," he said. "How can I refuse?" "I'm glad we understand each other," Veda said, "though I do apologize for the intrusion." The gunrunner waved a dismissive hand. "Save your apologies for Picus." He shot his bodyguard a scowl. "You know how dangerous Jirohanai can be when they've been embarrassed." "I do," Veda said, "and I'm not that worried." The gunrunner chuckled. "I imagine not." He leaned against the booth's backrest, then said, "So? Talk." "I need to hire one of your razors." The gunrunner's brow rose. He was big for a human, with shoulders as wide as a door and biceps the size of heat rockets, and Veda could see why his Venezian business partners called him the Goliath. After a moment, he asked, "As in the old UNSC Corvette? That kind of razor?" Veda nodded. "As in the old UNSC stealth corvette," she said. "And the UNSC isn't the only outfit operating them anymore. You know that better than anyone." The gunrunner assumed an innocent look. And why would I know that? Because Lieutenant Commander Hector Nieto commandeered 3 of them when he defected from the UNSC, Veda said. And you're Ross Nieto, his son. Nieto's posture grew tense, and his companions dropped their hands beneath the table. All 3 wore ballistic vests over bare torsos, a popular style that was more bad boy fashion than effective protection. Veda ran her gaze around the booth, locking eyes with each man until she saw a glimmer of uncertainty, then returned her attention to Nieto. Your father used those vessels to become a hero of the insurrection, Veda said. You used them to smuggle arms for Arlo Casillo. Nieto forced a neutral expression, but the color drained from his face. Arlo Casillo was the new president of the nearby planet Gao. He was also the most corrupt and ruthless politician in the entire sector. And before he had become president, he had been Veda's boss. To suggest they had parted on bad terms was an understatement. Casillo had risen to power during a military crisis of his own making, when he secretly helped a faction of ex-Covenant zealots assault a UNSC research battalion deployed on Gao. The resulting battle had destroyed an entire village and cost hundreds of innocent lives. The tragedy had given Casillo the leverage he needed to crush his political rivals and claim the presidency of the Gao Republic for himself. Ross Nieto's only involvement had been running arms shipments between Casillo and the zealots. But that had earned him a long list of enemies. The Unified Earth government wanted Nieto dead because he had helped arm ex-Covenant. Casillo wanted him dead because Nieto was one of the few people who knew of Casillo's involvement in the entire affair. And the Gao Ministry of War wanted him dead because his smuggling activities were a stain on the legacy of his heroic father. Veda just wanted to take him captive. Though that wasn't the primary objective of her first official mission leading a ferret team, it was more of a bonus. After giving Nieto a few seconds to worry, Veda said, "Relax. I'm only making sure you understand that I know who you are." Nieto's gaze flicked toward Veda's table and remained there as he studied the 3 street punks backing her up. "Then I'm afraid you have me at a disadvantage. Have we met?" "We have now." Veda slipped 2 fingers into her shirt pocket and removed a small leathron bag with a flex mag closure. "I'm the woman who wants to hire one of your razors. I hear the ghost flag can be underway by tonight." She squeezed the bag open, then emptied a line of shimmering spheres across the table, varying in size from that of a pea to a little larger than a human thumb tip. The spheres initially appeared more liquid than solid, like drops of water on the verge of erupting into splashes. After a moment in the light, they coalesced into solid balls and developed an iridescent glow so deep and bright, it seemed to be shining through a hole in the bottom of the universe. The tension in the air dissolved into wonder, and the man to Nieto's left gasped,
"Phase pearls. Where did you get those?"
"None of your business," Veda said. Technically known as boson beads, the gems were created by the plasma bombardment of a Forerunner hard light device. This particular batch had been collected on nearby Shaps 3 when the UNSC's 717th Xenomaterials Exploitation Battalion had sent a company to survey a Forerunner site that had been glassed a few months before. But Veda was not about to reveal that. Phase pearls were among the rarest gems known to man, and if she divulged the source, it wouldn't take a month for Shaps 3 to become one huge mining camp. She closed the bag and left it lying on the table, still half full and undulating, then looked back to Nieto. "That's more than enough to hire the ghost flag for a month," she said. "Probably for 2 months, come to think of it."
"Probably."
Nieto continued to eye the phase pearls for a moment, then finally looked up at Veda. "But that's not how I do business. I won't pay more." It wouldn't help. I'm not a gem dealer, and I don't run a transport service. My interests are more specialized. Naedo flashed a bright smile. I think you know that. I'm not sure what you're suggesting. Veda was careful to remain stone-faced. Naedo was starting to sniff at the bait, but she had to appear reluctant if she expected him to take it. I need a ride, not a partner. Naedo spread his hands. Then you've interrupted my lunch for nothing. Veda glowered at Naedo's half-empty cordial glass. You call that lunch? She reached for the pearl bag. Sorry we couldn't do business. The man to Naedo's left slapped a beefy hand over Veda's. You can leave those here. He was a moon-faced fellow with rough skin and slit eyes, a head shorter than Naedo, but almost as wide. Think of it as a consulting fee. Veda clamped her free hand over his. You're a funny man. She grabbed his thumb and peeled. When he tried to jerk loose, she slipped into a wrist lock and pivoted sideways, increasing her leverage and forcing him to flop across Naedo's lap. The pain compliance technique was one she had often used during her time as a special inspector in the Gao Ministry of Protection, and one she still preferred to the more lethal methods favored by her current employer. Chairs began to scrape across the floor as nervous patrons started for the exit, and she glimpsed her backup team moving to cover her. Olivia G-291 was already in front of the Jirohanai, pointing an M6P up at his face, while Mark G-313 and Ash G-099 were flanking Naedo's booth from opposite sides. With bloodshot eyes, hollow cheeks, and gold bling in their brows, nostrils, and lips, the trio looked like a crew of 20-year-old zone-outs. But that was just the makeup. They were actually closer to 15, and by far the most dangerous people in the room. Veda began to lift Moonface's arm, drawing a bellow of pain as the angle put pressure on his shoulder. She looked back to Naedo. This doesn't need to get bloody.
I'm glad to hear that.
The raspy, raised voice came from the near end of the bar, where a gray-haired man in a purple vest was emerging from a door marked Office. He was holding a glass of coppery liquid in one hand and nothing in the other, and he looked more irritated than alarmed.
The Georgi is a quiet place.
Naedo was quick to dip his chin. My apologies, Mr. Baklanov. He looked toward the line of patrons heading for the exit, then added, I hope you'll allow me to reimburse the trattoria for the disturbance. Baklanov nodded.
That will be fine.
He turned to a slender brunette woman behind the bar, then spoke loudly enough to make himself heard by everyone in the dining room.
The Goliath will be paying everyone's tab while he's here.
Naedo's smile grew strained.
It will be my pleasure.
The exodus slowed as human and Kigyar customers began to murmur and cackle, weighing the prospect of free drinks against the likelihood of a firefight breaking out any second. When they remained wary of returning to their tables, Baklanov turned to Veda and waved two fingers in her team's direction.
You and your friends are visitors here, he said. Maybe you should remember that.
Veda returned his stare, pretending she did not know who he was, then finally shrugged and began to ease Moonface's wrist toward the table.
All we want is what belongs to us, she said. As long as it's returned, there won't be any trouble.
Good, Baklanov said. Then it's decided.
He did not bother to ask Naedo's opinion. In addition to the Trattoria Georgi, which served as an informal meeting place for smugglers of all kinds, Georgi Baklanov controlled an orbital warehouse complex named Uishan Station. Between the two businesses, he facilitated fully half the black market commerce on Venezia, and any gunrunner foolish enough to defy him in his own establishment would soon be looking for a new planet to call home base. Veda motioned her team to secure their weapons. Once they had tucked the pistols into their belts, Baklanov swirled his drink and shot Naedo a warning look, then retreated into his office.
Naedo assumed a placating smile and gestured at Moonface. I apologize for Marco's manner. He only meant to say we'd like more information before making a counterproposal.
I don't have time for counterproposals. Veda released Marco's wrist completely. The offer is take it or leave it.
Why are you in such a hurry? Naedo eased Marco out of his lap, then said, You don't strike me as someone who plans poorly.
I'm not.
Veda began to collect the phase pearls off the table and returned them to their bag. You might say we had an equipment failure.
So you have your own vessel?
We did. Veda stole a glance at the patrons returning to their seats and noticed two thin-snouted Kigyar switching to a table closer to Naedo's booth. They were either information dealers or spies from an ex-covenant religious sect known as the Keepers of the One Freedom, and Veda was hoping for the latter. The Trattoria Georgi was a known hangout for the sect's smuggling gangs, and local sources reported that a Keeper gun-running crew was in port looking for a cargo. In fact, the whole point of approaching Naedo in public was to catch the attention of his Keeper rivals. Veda turned back to Naedo. You know anyone interested in a damaged crow? She asked. It can be repaired, but we really need to be on our way. Naedo's companions shifted in their seats, but he merely forced a smirk and tried to look indifferent. Crows are a little small for our operation, he said. But I can ask around. What series?
A modified S-77, Veda said.
Originally used as convoy accompaniment by private cargo hauling firms, Crows were lightly armored escort fighters. Obsolete by current standards, they were nevertheless so swift and packed with weapon systems that small pirate gangs still flew them as corsairs. We added 10 archer pods and a mini-mac. Naedo's smirk vanished. I didn't know a crow could carry that much firepower. We found a way. Veda closed the pearl bag. 5 pods on each side and the mini-mac under the belly. Now are you interested?
Not in the crow itself, Naedo said. But how you used it? That interests me.
What are you talking about?
The Taulanti, Naedo said. Someone hits a UNSC munitions ship in the Hispaniola sector. And do you think I won't hear about it?
That doesn't mean it was us.
No. The UNSC has been sniffing around the cab system for days now.
Naedo leaned across the table and spoke in a softer voice. They're boarding crows and looking for archers and mini-macs.
Still doesn't mean it was us, Veda said.
Naedo studied Veda through narrowed eyes, and she began to fear something in her manner had tipped him off. As a former detective, she'd done some undercover work, but nothing like this. And while she and her ferret team had just spent 5.5 months training for field operations, the one thing their Oni instructors had drilled into them from day one was that if something could go wrong on an op, it usually did. But after a moment, Naedo merely nodded and gave her a knowing smile.
Ah, it was you, he said. That's why you're in such a hurry.
That was a bold move, hitting a UNSC munitions ship, Marco added. But you didn't get away clean, and it's going to get you killed.
Not necessarily.
Naedo kept his eyes locked on Veda. They still have time. If they let us help them.
Great.
Veda dangled the pearl bag between her fingers. Half at the starport, half at the destination.
Like I said, that's not the way I work, Naedo replied. I want in.
Veda was careful to keep her brow furrowed and her mouth tight. Naedo was hooked, but the operation could still go bad.
In what? She asked.
Naedo's voice dropped to a whisper.
I want in on the nukes. From what I'm hearing, you got away with 10. I want 5. Can't do it.
Veda stole a glance toward the Trattoria office and found the Kigyar still seated at their new table. They were being sure to face one another instead of Naedo's booth. But their bulbous eyes were unfocused, and their dorsal head quills were standing on end. Good. Veda needed them to hear the Taulanti's story before she left the Trattoria Georgi. She turned back to Naedo.
Look. Okay. I can let you have some of the Argent Fives and Gauss cannons. But the Havocs?
She paused to make sure the Kig-Yar eavesdroppers heard her clearly, then shook her head.
The Havocs are already spoken for.
Better to deliver some than none, Naedo said. Blame the shortfall on me. I'm sure your clients will.
I told you we can't do it, Veda said. The people I work for? No one disappoints them.
She exhaled sharply, relying on the show of frustration to mask the prickle of apprehension digging at the base of her skull. She had just uttered the go phrase, and in about 4 minutes, all hell would break loose.
These people you work for, Naedo said. Who are they?
Sorry. Veda gave him a sardonic smile. I'd tell you, but then you'd have to kill me. Naedo rolled his eyes. Oh, please.
Seriously,
Olivia remarked. Her eyebrows and short-cropped hair had been bleached to a pale gold, and an ashen tint had been applied to her dark skin to make her look a bit unhealthy.
We'd have to kill you. All of you.
Nothing personal, Mark said. That's just the way it is.
Business is never personal, Naedo said.
He eyed Mark's sleeveless leather tunic and golden ear hoops with a show of disdain.
Not until some punk makes it that way.
Mark's eyes went cold.
Are you saying we're there now? Because that's fine with me.
Instead of answering, Naedo let his gaze drift toward the Trattoria's office, and Veda found herself hoping the gunrunner was about to do something stupid. He was not the reason she'd been forced to abandon her career in the Gao Ministry of Protection and flee her home planet under threat of death. But this man had smuggled weapons to the keepers of the One Freedom, the same ex-Covenant extremists whom Cassiel had used to seize the presidency of Gao. And now, the gunrunner was trying to get his hands on a clutch of nuclear warheads. As far as Veda was concerned, an Oni interrogation cell was too good for Ross Naedo. The sooner his body vanished down a black hole, the happier she would be. But Naedo was too smart, or too lucky, to be goaded into a foolish mistake. He continued to gaze in the direction of the office for another instant, then frowned, and Veda turned to find Georgi Baklanov stepping into the dining room again.
Okay, everybody out, Baklanov's voice boomed. We have Spartans coming.
A hush fell over the room, and patrons began to look toward the office door in doubt and confusion. Spartans were the elite of the elite, super soldiers so rare that only one civilian in 100 million had ever actually glimpsed one. To most of the Venezians in the room, the notion of a Spartan team raiding the Trattoria Georgi would sound almost inconceivable. Baklanov's voice grew low and urgent.
This is why I pay lookouts, people. Two Spartans just turned onto Via Natoli.
The hush broke into a speculative murmur. Via Natoli was long and narrow and notoriously choked with traffic, so even Spartans would find it slow going. And with all of the taverns and warehouses lining the lane, it certainly seemed possible that the super soldiers were headed somewhere else. Still, the Trattoria Georgi was a well-known black market hangout, and the trouble that had almost erupted earlier was unusual. A dozen patrons stood and started for the door. When the rest of the clientele were slow to follow, Baklanov extended a hand toward his office and made a summoning motion. Two henchmen stepped through the door, both brandishing Savine Arms 10mm machine pistols. At the same time, the bartender pulled another Samp 10 from behind the counter.
Let me make myself absolutely clear. You should leave now.
Baklanov's tone was growing calmer and steadier by the second. Anyone
still here in 60 seconds? The Spartans won't need to shoot.
The threat worked, because the remaining patrons mobbed the exit. Veda was glad to see the Kig-Yar eavesdroppers leading the way. Even if they were not keeper spies, they would spread the tale of the crazy human woman who had used a crow to steal 10 Havocs, and the keeper gunrunning crew would find her. All she and her team had to do now was make the coming fight with the Spartans look convincing. She tucked the phase pearls into her shirt pocket and motioned her team toward the kitchen. "We'll go out the back. They'll be expecting that." Nayeto remained seated, calmly waiting while his companions slid out of the booth. Those Spartans may be as dumb as canned fruit, but you can bet there's an Oni agent calling the shots. My guess is Oni has a sniper watching every exit, and they're just using the Spartans to flush you out. "Could be," Veda said. Nayeto had obviously never matched wits with a Spartan, or he wouldn't be comparing them to canned fruit. But his guess was only slightly inaccurate. She began to fear she had underestimated him. "If you have a better idea, I'm listening." "Do we have an agreement?" Nayeto slipped out of the booth and flashed a smirk. "We both know those Spartans are after you and your nukes. So either you split your haul with me, or you die and lose it all." Veda feigned hesitation, then glanced at her team and received 3 wary nods. Their reluctance was for show, but they were well-trained and had no trouble selling it. She turned to Nayeto. "You have a way to get us out of here fast?" she asked. "In one piece?" "Of course." "You expect me to take your word for it?" Veda asked. "No details, no deal." "Fair enough." Nayeto motioned to his Jirohanai bodyguard, then said, "We'll make our own door." "You want to bust through a side wall? An exterior wall?" Veda's clarification was for the benefit of the approaching Spartans. She had a thread-style microphone sewn in her collar, and everything it picked up was being transmitted to an encrypted comnet. "What about Mr. Butlinov?" "Give him a phase pearl," Nayeto said. "He won't complain." "That's enough for me to buy the whole building." "And what would you do with the place?" Nayeto asked. "Especially with Oni hunting you for the rest of your life." "Good point." She removed the pearl bag from her pocket and began to fumble at the closure, trying to buy time for the third Spartan, the one concealed in the service alley behind the trattoria, to change position. Nayeto's face tightened. "What's the holdup?" "The mag tab is sticking." Veda squeezed the bag open and began to sort through the pearls. "It does that sometimes." Nayeto waited about 2 seconds before reaching for his sidearm. "You're stalling." Knowing that her team's hands would already be on their M6Ps, Veda signaled them not to draw. Nayeto and his men were carrying new Tyne Armory 12mm Comets, a class of weapon Oni combat instructors mocked as hand cannons. The oversized pistols put the gunrunners at an enormous disadvantage in a quick-draw fight, so she had room to bluff this out. "The Spartans are coming for us," she said. "And you think I'm stalling?" Veda shook her head in mock disbelief, then withdrew one of the smaller phase pearls and summoned Ash over. His hair had been dyed orange and shaved into a flaming wing above each ear, but the rest of his head was bald. He was making a point of watching Nayeto. Not staring him down, just making sure the gunrunner knew that if things turned ugly, he would be the first to die. Nayeto seemed to take the hint. Despite his suspicious expression, he motioned to his men to wait. Veda put the phase pearl in Ash's hand. "Give this to Mr. Baklanov. With our apologies in advance for the damage," she said. The trattoria was nearly empty now, and Baklanov was close enough to overhear. "And hurry. We don't have much time." Ash eyed Baklanov's henchmen, then said, "We could just take them out." "And get stuck trading lead until the Spartans show?" Veda shook her head. "Just give him the pearl. It'll be faster." Ash shrugged. "If you say so." He handed his M6P to Veda, then pinched the phase pearl between his thumb and forefinger and started across the room. "Hey, Mr. B, I've got something for you." Veda heard a single click from the reception dot concealed near her eardrum, and she knew the third Spartan was in position to cover the expected exit route. It wouldn't be long before the other two arrived to flush the quarry into their trap. She turned to Ross Naito.
"We'd better still have a deal," she said. "I'd hate to lose one of my phase pearls for nothing."
Naito moved his hand away from his holster.
"You can't blame a man for being careful," he said. "I have my own reasons to be nervous about Spartans."
"That's not an answer."
"Maybe not, but it'll have to do for now."
Naito motioned his Jirohanai bodyguard toward the wall.
"Picus,
stop!"
Baklanov called. "Do that, and you're finished on Venezia."
Naito motioned Picus to wait, then faced the proprietor.
"Mr. Baklanov, trust me.
You don't want the Spartans to find us here."
"Sure I do,"
Baklanov said. "At least I'd like them to find your new friends." Veda turned to find Baklanov's henchmen swinging their SAMP-10 machine pistols toward her side of the room. Baklanov himself was pointing an 8mm automatic, a Savine Arms Defender, at Ash's face. Ash was still pinching the phase pearl between his thumb and forefinger, staring down the Defender's muzzle and looking more irritated than concerned. Mark and Olivia had drawn their M6Ps, but were keeping the muzzles pointed at the floor until they received an order to engage. Given his reflexes and training, Ash could easily pivot aside and take Baklanov's weapon away. And even firing from the waist, Mark and Olivia could take out the henchmen before their SAMP-10s settled on target. But then the team's cover would be blown, and the young ferrets had too much discipline to put their own lives ahead of the mission. It was a holdover from their Spartan 3 training, and one Veda feared would get them killed someday. She used a hand flick to signal wait, then glared at Baklanov.
"Have you lost your damn mind?"
Baklanov appeared to consider the possibility for a moment, then shook his head.
"Not the way I see it."
He gestured at the M6P in Veda's hand.
"You and your punks can put the pop guns on the floor."
"I don't think so."
Veda stepped toward Baklanov.
"What do you expect to happen here? What's it look like?"
Baklanov thumbed back the hammer of his defender, the unspoken threat bringing Veda to a halt.
"The Spartans want you and those nukes in a bad way. I turn you over, all my problems go away."
"Maybe because you're already dead," Ash said.
He rolled the phase pearl into the palm of his hand, then extended it toward Baklanov.
"Take it. You'll live longer."
Baklanov almost smiled.
"I like your style, kid. But I'll take my chances."
"With Oni?"
Veda asked. The mission planners had not foreseen Baklanov volunteering to help the UNSC.
Though maybe they should have.
In the field, anything could happen.
"You think those two Spartans don't know who you are? That you're not listed as a target of opportunity?"
Doubt filled Baklanov's eyes, and she realized she still had a chance to keep the mission on track. The two Spartans had to sell the ferret team's cover story by making it look like the UNSC was desperate to recover the stolen Havocs. But the deception required careful timing. The ferrets needed to escape just as the Spartans arrived, because nobody was going to believe a few lowlifes could survive a firefight with fully armored Spartans. Veda let Baklanov's skepticism build for a moment, then said,
"Look, if you try to strike a deal with those two Spartans, you'll end up in a body bag. The Goliath, too."
"Is that a threat?"
Baklanov's tone was tough, but the doubt was still there.
"Because I'm not a guy you want to threaten."
"I'm just telling you how it is."
Veda tipped her head toward the phase pearl in Ash's hand.
"You want to live? Take the pearl and follow us out of here. You want to die? Start a firefight. If we don't kill you, the Spartans will."
Baklanov's gaze shifted to the glowing bead in Ash's palm, and Veda realized she was winning him over. She let her breath out and heard a double click from the reception dot in her ear. Ash's eyes widened, and she knew he'd heard it too. The Spartans were about to breach, and her team was badly out of position. Veda gave her head a subtle rock, signaling her team to forget the plan and follow her lead. She did not relish the thought of improvising. That was usually when operatives got hurt. But Baklanov had forced her hand. She looked toward the wall-sized picture window in the front of the trattoria and spotted a pair of jackrabbit scout cycles on Via Natoli. Spread roughly a meter apart, they were cutting across traffic toward the trattoria. "Time's up, Mr. Baklanov." Veda swung her M6P toward the front window. "Now we die." The two jackrabbits reached the walkway, scattering pedestrians in all directions, then accelerated hard. Their front wheels rose into the air and crashed through the trattoria's window just above the sill. Veda opened fire on the nearest cycle, and the cockpit canopy shattered beneath two explosive rounds. She fired again, aiming for the driver's faceplate. His shields shimmered as the round detonated, and his helmet vanished behind a fiery orange flash. The jackrabbit veered toward the bar and slammed into the side, causing an eruption of polished stone and dark wood. Veda glimpsed blue Mjolnir armor and knew the Spartan she'd just shot was the leader of the legendary blue team, Fred 104. It was what a pirate would have done, but still, he was a friend. By then, Ash was wrenching the defender out of Baklanov's hand, and Mark and Olivia were blasting the wheels off the second jackrabbit. A Spartan in gray Mjolnir with a half-bubble faceplate, the second member of blue team, Kelly 087, bailed out and rolled across the floor, reaching for her sidearm. Mark and Olivia continued to fire, enveloping her in an orange aura as their rounds detonated against her energy shield. Baklanov stepped toward the gray-armored Spartan and held up his now weaponless hand, motioning her to wait. Like that was going to happen. They were in the middle of a firefight, and Kelly's hand came up holding her sidearm. Blood sprayed the wall as the M6C's armor-piercing round exited through the back of his purple vest. Ash returned fire using Baklanov's defender, but the weapon's hollow-point ammo just disintegrated against her shields. Kelly swung the M6C toward Ash. Then Baklanov's henchmen opened fire on her with their SAMP-10s, and she had to dive into an evasive roll. Tables and chairs dissolved into splinters behind her. Fred rose from the bar's wreckage and sprayed the henchmen with mini-bursts from his assault rifle. The machine pistols fell from their hands, and all three collapsed where they stood, each bleeding from a line of holes stitched across his torso. The roar of the SAMP-10s had barely faded before Rosnaedo's men began to boom away with their comets. Kelly's energy shield crackled with overload static and went down, and flakes of titanium alloy began to spall off her armor. The Spartans brought their own fire to bear almost instantly, and the first of Naieto's men dropped. Then Mark staggered back, blood pouring from his shoulder. Whether he had been hit by a stray bullet or deliberately wounded to help sell the ferret team's cover story, Veda didn't know. And it didn't matter. The entire operation was a desperate ploy. The keepers of the One Freedom had assassinated an admiral and abducted her family, and the trail was running cold. Oni's best hope of drawing the kidnappers into the open was to dangle a bunch of stolen Havocs in their home territory, and hope they took the bait. Veda swung her M6P toward Fred and fired her last round. His shields were already down, and the shot caught him in the middle of his chest armor. The detonation barely rocked him, but he used it as an excuse to fire his next burst high. Veda tossed the pocket pistol aside and reached down to grab a SAMP-10. Then a large hand clasped her arm and drew her away. She looked over to find Rosnaedo grasping her biceps, yelling something she could not hear above the thunder of the firefight. Only one of Naieto's three men remained standing, but Picus, the Jirohanai bodyguard, was by the corner booth, hurling himself into the plaster-finished wall. The impact sent a shiver through his entire body and rocked him back on his heels, and Veda's heart caught for an instant. If the brute failed to breach the wall, their escape from the Spartans would become a lot less believable, and the Keeper gun-running crew a lot less likely to show themselves. Picus drew back, then threw himself at the wall again. This time a structural panel buckled, and he disappeared into a cloud of billowing dust. Green Venezian light began to pour into the room through a 3-meter hole, and Veda allowed Naieto to pull her across the booth toward the opening. Outside, Veda could see the wood-planked side street emptying as pedestrians raced away from the firefight. Picus was kneeling in a pile of rubble, shaking his head and gathering himself to rise. The Jirohanai's head snapped sideways and sprayed blood, and he collapsed onto his flank and began to convulse. Nayato put out a hand, signaling Veda to wait behind him, then stared at the brute's shuddering body as though he could not quite understand what had just happened. There were three holes in the bodyguard's massive temple, surrounded by powder stippling and arranged in a triangle so tight, it was almost a single wound. Which meant the attack had come from close range, no more than a couple of meters away. Nayato dropped to his haunches and duck-walked into the hole. Veda took the chance to glance back into the trattoria and saw that Nayato's last man had fallen. Ash and Olivia had each retrieved a comet and were continuing to blast away at the two Spartans, who were returning fire with their assault rifles. Mark was ignoring the blood pouring from his shoulder and using a Samp 10 to spray the wall above Fred's head. No one was hitting anyone, but they were all making it look damn good. Veda caught Olivia's attention by tossing a piece of loose plaster past her shoulder, then signaled her to collect Mark and Ash and disengage. When she turned forward again, Nayeta was still squatting, holding his comet in both hands and cautiously leaning forward to peer outside. She drew her leg back and planted a boot in the middle of his back, stomp-kicking him out onto the walkway. A female Spartan in copper-tinted Mjolnir armor stepped into view. Wearing a goggle-eyed Argus-class helmet with extra sensor boxes on the sides, she was the third member of Blue Team, Linda 058. She placed a titanium boot on Nayato's weapon arm, then looked up and gave a curt nod as Veda and her team clambered out onto the walkway. The gesture was not lost on Nayato, who craned his neck to watch the ferret team race past.
"Who are you?"
he called.
"Why did you—"
The question ended in a thump as Linda brought her assault rifle down, using the pressure point at the hinge of Nayato's jaw to knock him unconscious. She kicked the comet away from his hand. Then Veda lost sight of them as the ferret spilled into the street and sprinted for the intersection with Via Natale. They had taken about five steps when triple round bursts began to crack from Linda's assault rifle. Olivia cried out, and Veda looked over to see her staggering as she struggled to regain her stride. There was a fresh bullet hole in the thigh of her dark pants, and blood pouring down both sides of her leg. First Mark takes a bullet, now Olivia. That was half of her squad wounded. Veda was beginning to think Blue Team was trying a little too hard to make the chase look real. She slipped a hand under Olivia's arm and pulled her along for two steps. Once Olivia's stride evened out, she twisted around, allowing Veda to guide her while she fired the big comet over her shoulder. Ash and Mark were both doing the same, though parked scooter trucks and tri-wheel minivans seemed to be taking most of the damage. They reached Via Natale a few steps later. Veda led the way around the corner, away from the Trattoria Georgi. Traffic in the intersection had deteriorated into an impassable snarl of crashed and abandoned vehicles, but the walkway cleared ahead of them as alarmed pedestrians ducked into shops or hid between parked vehicles. Despite their wounds, Mark and Olivia had no trouble keeping up. If anything, their injuries only made them faster, a result of the biological augmentations they had received during their Spartan III training. Veda studied the warehouses ahead, looking for a red awning over a pair of green doors. This part of New Tyne had been built atop a swamp, and the red awning marked a building with a trap door that descended to a loading dock. To make their escape look credible, the ferrets had left a shallow draft airboat there, but they didn't have much time to reach it. Blue Team could hold back only a few seconds without making it obvious that they were deliberately delaying pursuit. The red awning came into view 40 paces away, far enough from the action that confused pedestrians were still clustering in front of it. Veda glanced back and saw onlookers beginning to drift onto the walkway behind her. Beyond the gawkers, almost seeming to float above their heads in Venezia's hazy air, two large Spartan helmets were emerging from the ruins of Trattoria Georgi. There was no sign of the Kigyar eavesdroppers, which Veda decided to take as a good sign. Given the circumstances, It would only make sense for a pair of keeper spies to avoid showing themselves. Veda continued to watch as the two Spartans, Fred and Kelly, started to pursue. She knew Linda would not be joining them. Instead, the third Spartan would be busy securing Ross Naieto for transport to an Oni interrogation facility. At least that part of the operation had gone right.
Do not slow down!
Veda's ears had stopped ringing enough that she could hear her own voice, so she hoped the rest of her team could too.
If we need to clear a lane, fire warning!
Olivia's arm came up, catching Veda across the chest so forcefully the impact almost knocked her off her feet. She caught her balance and heard a vehicle clanging to a halt in front of her, then turned to find a tri-wheel minivan screeching to a full stop across the walkway. The side door slid open. A tri-digit hand motioned them inside, and a scaly Kigyar face peered out.
"If you want to live," he said, "come with us."
Chapter 2 11:22 hours, December 8th, 2553, military calendar. UNSC passenger schooner Denoma, Deep Space Transitional Zone, Tisiphone System. Operation Retribution had been set into motion 4 days earlier, after Veda and her ferret team were summoned to a deep space rendezvous with the UNSC passenger schooner Denoma. They had entered the vessel through a temporary airlock, and found themselves floating in a zero-G slaughterhouse. The Denoma's wardroom had been breached inward by a powerful detonation, and Veda could tell from the blood spatter that the blast had hurled three occupants into the far wall. Near the top of each pattern, an ovoid dent indicated where their heads had impacted, so it seemed likely that all three victims had been dead or unconscious when the cabin decompressed, and sent their pressure-bloated corpses tumbling into the void. Fortunately for Veda, who still found it awkward to work in a pressure suit, the temporary airlock had sealed the breach and allowed the Denoma to be repressurized. So even if the vessel lacked gravity, at least it had a standard atmosphere. Veda spun toward Rear Admiral Saren Osman, the officer who had summoned her to the scene. A slender woman with short cropped hair and high cheekbones, the Admiral wore a thruster harness over blue camouflage utilities. There was no unit patch or name tag, only a single black star on each collar tip. If you didn't know she was Oni, you weren't paying attention.
"Did they recover the bodies?" Veda asked.
"Not yet." Osman was the current head of the Beta 5 Division of Section 3 Operations, which ran the Spartan programs and most of Oni's other black ops, and helped oversee an array of reverse engineering programs that used alien technology to create new weapons and devices for the UNSC. She was among the most powerful of Oni's division heads and, according to rumor, being groomed to take over as the agency's commander-in-chief when Margaret Perengoski finally retired.
"We have a squadron of storks running a search cone.
But you know how it is. Dead bodies are small. Deep space is big. And the commanding investigator tells me the assault happened 7 days ago. I don't expect any recoveries."
"Let's hope they prove you wrong," Veda said. She really wanted to see the bodies.
More often than not, the bodies told the story.
"How long has the IRI team been aboard?"
2 days, Osman said. Piracy had grown so common in the outer colonies that the UNSC had an entire incident response and investigation branch, dedicated to identifying and locating perpetrators. But they haven't removed anything from the scene. I wanted you to have a look first.
"Because IRI investigators aren't good enough?"
"Because there's a lot at stake," Osman said, "and I need answers fast."
"I'm flattered, but
Lopez, you were Gao's best homicide investigator. Just give me something we can use to identify the killers. I'll take care of the rest." Mark used a maneuvering thruster to move to Osman's side.
"Isn't that what we've been training for, Admiral?"
Like Ash and Olivia, he wore plain gray utilities, and his adolescent face showed no sign of the piercings and jewelry that would adorn it in the coming days.
"To identify problems and take care of them.
Mark, when Admiral Osman has a job for us,
She'll say so, Feta said. Unlike her subordinates, she was in no hurry to interrupt their ferret training and start working in the field. Deep penetration black ops had a way of going sideways, and so far her young Spartan threes were still far better soldiers than they were secret agents. For now, let's concentrate on giving the Admiral what she's asked for. Mark frowned, but said, Yes, ma'am. Just let me know what my assignment is. How about you check the Denoma's weapons inventory, both ship-to-ship and personal, Feta said. The task was more than a way to keep Mark busy. As her team's security specialist, he was the one most qualified to evaluate what combat tactics the crew might have employed in an attempt to fend off the borders. That should give us some idea of how the fight progressed, and how quickly. Very well, ma'am. Mark turned to Osman and saluted. He nodded to Veda before departing, but skipped the salute. Although Veda was an Oni operative, that did not make her a military officer, which suited her just fine. As a Gao native, she still had a few anti-centralization feelings, and swearing an oath of loyalty to the UNSC might be more than she was ready for. Veda drifted to the center of the wardroom and spun in a slow circle, assessing the scene. Judging by the swab smears on the walls and the evidence tags affixed to the floor, the IRI investigators had done a good job of collecting trace evidence. Eventually, those efforts might reveal something that pointed to the attacker's identity. But scientific analysis took time, and if Osman had been willing to wait, she would not have jerked Veda's team out of its final weeks of ferret training to look at a crime scene. Anything, Lopez? Osman asked. Yeah, a little. Veda pointed at the jagged edges of the breach, which had been curled inward by the blast and were coated with dried blood. There were a lot of people sucked out through that breach. More than died here in the wardroom. Veda turned away from the damaged hull and carefully used her thruster harness to cross the wardroom. It had been only 5.5 months since she had experienced weightlessness for the first time, and while the sensation had grown familiar, she still preferred walking and lamented the absence of the Denoma's artificial gravity field. A moment later, she had successfully maneuvered herself into position next to the doorway. Rather than a hatch, the wardroom was serviced by an automatic door, which had jammed 10 centimeters out of its storage pocket. She grabbed the leading edge and pulled herself down to examine a blood smear on the floor. Struggling to hold herself steady while she worked, Veda noted that the smear seemed to be streaking toward the breach in the hull. She ran her fingers inside the door's receiver slot and found a tuft of bristly brown hair stuck inside the sealing gasket. When she raised the hair to her nose, it smelled musky and acrid. Veda passed the tuft to Osman, who was following at a polite distance. You recognize that smell? Jirahanai, Osman said. That's not a surprise. Why not? You'll see, Osman said. So what do you think? I think a Jirahanai corpse was jamming the door open. Veda ran her fingers along the inside of the receiving slot again, this time about midway up its height, and came away with crusted blood. When the boarding party withdrew and left in their vessel, the wardroom decompressed a second time. A lot of bodies from deeper in Denoma were drawn out past the Jirahanai. Eventually, he was dislodged, and got sucked out of the breach himself. Osman nodded. That makes sense, she said. The banished don't usually stick around to make a target airtight after they're done. The banished? Veda asked, not hiding her surprise. The banished were a fast-growing, tech-savvy horde of marauders. Since the closing days of the war, they'd been causing trouble for humans and the Covenant Empire by pillaging ships, installations, and even entire worlds in a relentless pursuit of cutting-edge weapons technology. You think they did this? So you don't? Osman asked. She was watching Veda closely, clearly trying to gauge her reaction. Why not? I don't think anything yet, Veda said. I haven't seen enough evidence. Unless you're holding something back. Osman shook her head. At this stage, the banished are just an assumption, she said. Forget I mentioned them. I need you to draw your own conclusions. But hold on, Olivia said. She hit her thrusters and drifted close. You think it was the Banished. Did some lame brain put equipment on the Denoma we should know about? Osman scowled. What part of Forget I Mentioned Them wasn't clear, Petty Officer? Olivia's expression grew contrite. Sorry, Admiral, she said. I didn't realize the lame brain was you. It wasn't, Osman said. Shouldn't you be pissing off the ship's AI or something? Yes, ma'am. I'll get right on that. Olivia saluted and maneuvered toward the doorway. As the ferret team's information specialist, she had been developed into an elite hacker who could plunder almost any processing system. Veda pushed out of the doorway to let her float past. Look for infiltration routines, Veda said, now speaking to Olivia's boots, and anything that explains what the Denoma was doing way out here in the transitional zone. Affirmative, Olivia called back. Once she had disappeared around the corner, Osman sighed and asked, What are you thinking she'll find, Lopez? I'm not sure, Veda said. But whoever attacked the Denoma didn't stumble on her by accident. Not at the edge of the system. They knew she would be here. Ash now spoke up. That doesn't sound like the Banished. They're not exactly subtle, are they? Osman's thrusters hissed as she rotated to face him. At first, Veda thought Osman would reprimand him as harshly as she had Olivia. But Ash merely gave a look of calm expectation, and the irritation on Osman's face faded to impatience. Ash, you know better than that, Osman said. You never underestimate an enemy. I don't think I am, ma'am, Ash said. I'm just saying. The Banished aren't inside operators. The corners of Osman's mouth started to drop, and Veda decided Ash needed backup. Taking the subject's usual modus operandi into consideration isn't underestimating him, Admiral, she said. If the Banished haven't used espionage tactics in the past, we need a sound reason to think they're using them now. Are you saying their tactics have evolved? Osman hesitated, then said, We don't have any intelligence to confirm that. But look at how brutal the attack was. How fast. That characterizes the attack. But it's not evidence, Veda said. We don't have time to cross every T and dot every I, Osman replied, fuming. We need to identify these bastards, and we need to do it now. Veda did not respond immediately. Outbursts were rare for the Admiral, so the fact that she had lost control even a little suggested a personal element was involved, one that was making her desperate to push Veda toward the Banished being the culprit. Once the ire had drained from Osman's face, Veda asked, Admiral, is there some reason you need these attackers to be the Banished? Osman looked as though she were biting back a sharp reply, then let out a long breath and spoke more calmly. What I need is a quick answer, she said. I have a prowler watching a Banished flotilla in the Nereus system. Ah, and you think they might be the Denoma's attackers, Veda surmised. Nereus was the next star earthward, an uninhabited system of ice balls and dust-smothered rocks that would be a perfect spider hole for a pirate horde. How long do we have? Impossible to know. They're holding in orbit at the 10th planet. The Prowler captain thinks they might be waiting for a rendezvous. But we don't have intelligence on that. I don't see the problem, Admiral, Ash said. Who cares whether they're the ones who hit the Denoma? It's still a Banished flotilla. Just tell Sector Command to send in a task force. I can't do that yet, Osman said. Not until I know whether it's an attack mission or a rescue. Rescue? Ash fell silent for a moment, then said, Oh. Veda asked, Who needs rescuing? Three passengers from the Denoma, Osman said. Civilians. Ash looked troubled. And you spent 2 days waiting for us? 2 days is an eternity when the target is mobile. Nothing gets past you, does it? Osman said. But the Prowler spotted the flotilla a few hours ago. And I only just received word. If your arrival hadn't been imminent, I'd already have sent orders to launch a rescue mission.
Then there's reason to believe the victims are still alive,